Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 3, Chapter 1X, which is 9, and let's jump right in. The day after the review, Boris, in his best uniform and with his comrade Berg's best wishes for success, rode to Olmutz to see Bolkonski, wishing to profit by his friendliness and obtain for himself the best post he could, preferably that of adjutant, to some important personage, a position in the army which seemed to him most attractive. It is all very well for Rostov, whose father sends him 10,000 rubles at a time, to talk about not wishing to cringe to anybody and not be anyone's lackey. But I, who have nothing but my brains, have to make a career, and must not miss opportunities, but must avail myself of them, he reflected. He did not find Prince Andrew in Olmutz that day, but the appearance of the town where the headquarters and the diplomatic corps were stationed, and the two emperors were living with their suites, households, and courts, only strengthened his desire to belong to that higher world. He knew no one, and despite his smart guardsman uniform, all these exalted personages passing in the streets in their elegant carriages with their plumes, ribbons, and medals, both courtiers and military men, seemed so immeasurably above him, an insignificant officer of the guards, that they not only did not wish to, but simply could not, be aware of his existence. At the quarters of the commander-in-chief, Kutuzov, where he inquired for Bolkonski, all the adjutants and even the orderlies looked at him as if they wished to impress on him that a great many officers like him were always coming there, and that everybody was heartily sick of them. In spite of this, or rather because of it, next day, November the 15th, after dinner, he again went to Olmutz, and entering the house occupied by Kutuzov, asked for Bolkonski. Prince Andrew was in, and Boris was shown into a large hall, probably formerly used for dancing, but in which 5 beds now stood, and furniture of various kinds, a table, chairs, and a clavichord. One adjutant, nearest the door, was sitting at the table in a Persian dressing gown, writing. Another, the red stout Nesvitsky, lay on a bed with his arms under his head, laughing with an officer who had sat down beside him. A third was playing a Viennese waltz on the clavichord, while a fourth, lying on the clavichord, sang the tune. Bolkonski was not there. None of these gentlemen changed his position on seeing Boris. The one who was writing, and whom Boris addressed, turned round crossly and told him Bolkonski was on duty, and that he should go through the door on the left into the reception room if he wished to see him. Boris thanked him and went to the reception room, where he found some 10 officers and generals. When he entered, Prince Andrew, his eyes drooping contemptuously, with that peculiar expression of polite wariness which plainly says, if it were not my duty, I would not talk to you for a moment, was listening to an old Russian general with decorations, who stood very erect, almost on tiptoe, with a soldier's obsequious expression on his purple face, reporting something. "Very well, then. Be so good as to wait," said Prince Andrew to the general in Russian, speaking with the French intonation he affected when he wished to speak contemptuously, and noticing Boris, Prince Andrew, paying no more heed to the general, who ran after him, imploring him to hear something more, nodded and turned to him with a cheerful smile. At that moment, Boris clearly realized what he had before surmised, that in the army, besides the subordination and discipline prescribed in the military code, which he and the others knew in the regiment, there was another more important subordination which made this tight-laced, purple-faced general wait respectfully while Captain Prince Andrew, for his own pleasure, chose to chat with Lieutenant Drubetskoy. More than ever was Boris resolved to serve in future not according to the written code, but under this unwritten law. He felt now that merely by having been recommended to Prince Andrew, he had already risen above the general who, at the front, had the power to annihilate him, a lieutenant of the guards. Prince Andrew came up to him and took his hand. "I am very sorry you did not find me in yesterday. I was fussing about with Germans all day. We went with Weyrother to survey the dispositions. When Germans start being accurate, there's no end to it." Boris smiled, as if he understood what Prince Andrew was alluding to as something generally known, but it was the first time he had heard Weyrother's name, or even the term dispositions. "Well, my dear fellow, so you still want to be an adjutant? I have been thinking about you." "Yes, I was thinking," for some reason Boris could not help blushing, "of asking the Commander-in-Chief. He has had a letter from Prince Kurágin about me. I only wanted to ask because I fear the guards won't be in action," he added, as if in apology. "All right, all right. We'll talk it over," replied Prince Andrew. "Only let me report this gentleman's business, and I shall be at your disposal." While Prince Andrew went to report about the purple-faced general, that gentleman evidently not sharing Boris's conception of the advantages of the unwritten code of subordination, looked so fixedly at the presumptuous lieutenant who had prevented his finishing what he had to say to the adjutant, that Boris felt uncomfortable. He turned away and waited impatiently for Prince Andrew's return from the Commander-in-Chief's room. "You see, my dear fellow, I have been thinking about you," said Prince Andrew when they had gone into the large room where the clavichord was. "It's no use your going to that Commander-in-Chief. He would say a lot of pleasant things, ask you to dinner. That would not be bad as regards the unwritten code," thought Boris. "But nothing more would come of it. There will soon be a battalion of us aides-de-camp and adjutants, but this is what we'll do. I have a good friend, an adjutant-general and an excellent fellow, Prince Dolgorukov. And though you may not know it, the fact is that now Kutuzov, with his staff and all of us, count for nothing. Everything is now centred round the Emperor. So we will go to Dolgorukov. I have to go there anyhow, and I have already spoken to him about you. We shall see whether he cannot attach you to himself or find a place for you somewhere nearer the sun." Prince Andrew always became specially keen when he had to guide a young man and help him to worldly success. Under cover of obtaining help of this kind for another, which from pride he would never accept for himself, he kept in touch with the circle which confers success and which attracted him. He very readily took up Boris's cause and went with him to Dolgorukov. It was late in the evening when they entered the palace at Olmutz, occupied by the emperors and their retinues. That same day a council of war had been held in which all the members of the Hofgerichtsgraf and both emperors took part. At that council, contrary to the views of the old generals Kutuzov and Prince Schwarzenberg, it had been decided to advance immediately and give battle to Bonaparte. The council of war was just over when Prince Andrew, accompanied by Boris, arrived at the palace to find Dolgorukov. Everyone at the headquarters was still under the spell of the day's council, at which the party of the young had triumphed. The voices of those who counselled delay and advised waiting for something else before advancing had been so completely silenced and their arguments confuted by such conclusive evidence of the advantages of attacking that what had been discussed at the council, the coming battle and the victory that would certainly result from it, no longer seemed to be in the future but in the past. All the advantages were on our side. Our enormous forces, undoubtedly superior to Napoleon's, were concentrated in one place. The troops inspired by the Emperor's presence were eager for action. The strategic position where the operations would take place was familiar in all its details to the Austrian General Weyrother. A lucky accident had ordained that the Austrian army should manoeuvre the previous year on the very fields where the French had now to be fought. The adjacent locality was known and shown in every detail on the maps, and Bonaparte, evidently weakened, was undertaking nothing. Dolgorukov, one of the warmest advocates of an attack, had just returned from the council, tired and exhausted but eager and proud of the victory that had been gained. Prince Andrew introduced his protege, but Prince Dolgorukov, politely and firmly pressing his hand, said nothing to Boris, and evidently unable to suppress the thoughts which were uppermost in his mind at that moment, addressed Prince Andrew in French. "Ah, my dear fellow, what a battle we have gained. God grant that the one that will result from it will be as victorious. However, my dear fellow," he said abruptly and eagerly, "I must confess to having been unjust to the Austrians, and especially to Weyrother. What exactitude, what minuteness, what knowledge of the locality, what foresight for every eventuality, every possibility, even to the smallest detail. No, my dear fellow, no conditions better than our present ones could have been devised. This combination of Austrian precision with Russian valour, what more could be wished for?" "So the attack is definitely resolved on?" asked Bolkonski. "And do you know, my dear fellow, it seems to me that Bonaparte has decidedly lost his bearings. You know that a letter was received from him today from the Emperor." Dolgorukov smiled insignificantly. "Is that so? And what does it say?" inquired Bolkonski. "What can he say? Tra-di-ri-di-ra, and so on, merely to gain time. I tell you, he is in our hands, that's certain. But what was most amusing," he continued with a sudden good-natured laugh, "was that he could not think how to address the reply. If not as counsel, and of course not as emperor, it seemed to me it should be to General Bonaparte. But between not recognizing him as emperor and calling him General Bonaparte, there is a difference," remarked Bolkonski. "That's just it," interrupted Dolgorukov quickly, laughing. "You know, Bilibin, he's a very clever fellow. He suggested addressing him as usurper and enemy of mankind." Dolgorukov laughed merrily. "Only that," said Bolkonski. "All the same, it was Bilibin who found a suitable form for the address. He is a wise and clever fellow." "What was it?" "To the head of the French government, or chef du gouvernement français," said Dolgorukov with a grave satisfaction. "Good, wasn't it?" "Yes, but he will dislike it extremely," said Bolkonski. "Oh, yes, very much. My brother knows him. He's dined with him, the present emperor, more than once in Paris, and tells me he never met a more cunning or subtle diplomatist. You know, a combination of French adroitness and Italian play-acting. Do you know the tale about him and Count Markov?" Count Markov was the only man who knew how to handle him. "You know the story of the handkerchief. It is delightful." And the talkative Dolgorukov, turning now to Boris, now to Prince Andrew, told how Bonaparte, wishing to test Markov, our ambassador, purposely dropped a handkerchief in front of him and stood looking at Markov, probably expecting Markov to pick it up for him, and how Markov immediately dropped his own beside it and picked it up without touching Bonaparte's. "Delightful," said Bolkonski. "But I have come to you, Prince, as a petitioner on behalf of this young man. You see..." But before Prince Andrew could finish, an aide-de-camp came in to summon Dolgorukov to the Emperor. "Oh, what a nuisance," said Dolgorukov, getting up hurriedly and pressing the hands of Prince Andrew and Boris. "You know, I should be very glad to do all in my power, both for you and for this dear young man." Again he pressed the hand of the latter, with an expression of good-natured, sincere and animated levity. "But you see, another time." Boris was excited by the thought of being so close to the higher powers as he felt himself to be at that moment. He was conscious that here he was in contact with the springs that set in motion the enormous movement of the mass of which, in his regiment, he felt himself a tiny, obedient and insignificant atom. They followed Prince Dolgorukov out into the corridor and met, coming out of the door of the Emperor's room by which Dolgorukov had entered, a short man in civilian clothes, with a clever face and sharply projecting jaw which, without spoiling his face, gave him a peculiar vivacity and shiftiness of expression. The short man nodded to Dolgorukov as to an intimate friend, and stared at Prince Andrew with cool intensity, walking straight towards him and evidently expecting him to bow or to step out of his way. Prince Andrew did neither. A look of animosity appeared on his face, and the other turned away and went down the side of the corridor. "Who was that?" asked Boris. "He is one of the most remarkable, but to me most unpleasant of men, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Prince Adam Czartoryski. It is such men as he who decide the fate of nations," added Bolkonski with a sigh he could not suppress as they passed out of the palace. Next day the army began its campaign, and up to the very Battle of Austerlitz, Boris was unable to see either Prince Andrew or Dolgorukov again, and remained for a while with the Ismailov regiment. All right, there we have it, another chapter down, and it seems that Boris is very much his mother's son. He says at one point something along the lines to Nikolai that, you know, Nikolai will just get money sent to him. He doesn't really have to do anything, but Boris has to focus on his career and try to get ahead that way if he's going to make anything of himself. So very much like his mother, he's not afraid to climb the social ladder by any means necessary. Now, before we go further into this chapter, in the last podcast I asked what your thoughts on Nikolai Rostov are so far. And I've got a couple of answers here. So, perfect place to start, said, "Nikolai is not my favourite character in the book so far, but he is definitely an interesting one. He is a little hot-headed, prideful, and a bit naive. I suppose a real teenager. The chapters in which he appears have been fun to read. I think we'll see him maturing and developing more through the course of this war." Mellow Yellow said, "I totally agree. I foresee his hot-headedness and naivety putting Nikki in difficult and troublesome situations that'll precipitate his maturity and growth. I may hate this character now, but I see myself potentially finding his story arc appealing." Thunder Perfect said, "I definitely thought he was more likable in the chapters we were introduced to him in, and now I see him pop up, I'm just like, ugh, not one of the more enjoyable moments at this point." Yeah, he's a funny one. I like the chapters he's in. He makes the chapters quite interesting. But he's not that likable as a person, as a character. But as a writer, I quite like an unlikable character because I think they make stories really interesting. And he's not beyond salvation. I think he could mature up and actually be a good, you know, make a fine man of himself. But at the moment, he's a little bit on the hot-headed and naive side, as Perfect Place to Start said. All right, back onto this current chapter. Reddit user Quitterset said, "I like Boris's description of and reaction to the two different sets of rules, the formal chain of command and the more subtle undercurrent by which a general is seeking to curry favour with and can be set aside by a captain like Andrei Bolkonski. He's essentially describing how networking with the right people can lob you into the halls of power, which is as true today as it was in Tolstoy's era. Same thing with Tolstoy's comment about how Andrei likes to help the careers of younger men, not so much for their own sake, but because it gives him the opportunity to stay in touch with his circle. It brings to mind the networking principle that asking people to help you out with something is likely to make them feel more favourable towards you." Here, Andrei can use the premise of introducing Boris to Dolgorukov as a chance to both A, let Dolgorukov feel generous by doing him a favour, and B, get information about the outcome of a council he did not get to attend. PKI Guy 22 said, "I think Boris is smart to use his connections to improve himself, although I feel like it's going to be a while longer before he sees the benefit of this interaction. It is totally a trap, and I get the feeling that Rostov will be someone we hear about during the outcome." That's an interesting take. Where is there more glory to be found? Rostov, who just wants to get out there and fight, or Boris, who wants to progress up the career ladder, the military ranks? Reddit user Chattelvelster asked, "We hear in this chapter that the choice has been made for the offensive because Napoleon isn't undertaking anything and all the advantages are on our side. Do you think this is just the right decision, or do you think this might be a trap set by Napoleon? The Shiner responded to this saying, well, the history of Napoleon fighting the Russians is generally not a happy one for the Russians. Even when they manage to turn him back, it's more a Fabian retreat that does it than anything else. The Shiner also went on to talk about that scene where they debated what to call Napoleon in their response letter to him. The Shiner said, the idea of debating what to call Napoleon was also fascinating. I'm sure in international diplomacy those kinds of titles carry meaningful weight, and calling him simply head of the French government would be a slight to someone who fancies himself an emperor in any era. I tried to do some Googling, but not surprisingly, the primary source for Napoleons are vast, and in a bit of looking, I couldn't find examples of how Russians or any other foreign power addressed him in their correspondence. Yeah, there are very many, many, many books and resources on Napoleon, so much that it becomes impossible to sort of separate fact from fiction. I saw in a documentary recently that the guy who made A Clockwork Orange in 2001, what's his name, Stanley Kubrick, his last project he was working on was a movie about Napoleon, and he had this gigantic chest of drawers, and in each drawer was just like note cards with information about Napoleon, and he was trying to make this chronological like filing cabinet of Napoleon's life, and it was an unfinished job. But and then in the background of this there was a gigantic bookshelf just with, you know, thousands of books, and they were all about Napoleon. And I think I read recently that it might be a fact, or I might have got this wrong, but it was something along the lines of there's more books about Napoleon than anyone else. You'd think that that would make it really easy to know everything about the guy, but I think there's so much exaggeration around the man that you don't know what's true and what isn't. Anyway, that was just a quick one for today. We'll end the episode there. Thanks to everyone who's been sharing the podcast. It's really made a big difference. And if you can continue to do so, give it a share, show it to your Facebook friends and groups. I would really appreciate that. Thanks very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.